Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to another classic replay from the Unbelievable podcast. We've been bringing you conversations that matter for over a decade and a half, and I've got a great one for you from the archive today. Today's show was first broadcast in July 2010 when Christian barrister and author Charles Foster met atheist psychologist Susan Blackmore to debate whether spiritual experiences and the nature of our consciousness suggest we are wired for God or not. Don't forget, you can keep up to date with the latest from the show, get in touch and find many more evergreen debates on big questions at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
You're unbelievable.
The topic today is the biology of spiritual experience. Charles Foster is my studio guest today. He's a barrister and writer, writes on all kinds of different subjects, but has been looking at the whole aspect of whether we're wired for God, and that's the name of his latest book, Wired for God? Things like out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, the kind of psychedelic trips of drug users. What does this tell us about spiritual, religious experiences, about what happens in the brain? Well, we're going to be in conversation today with atheist guest Susan Blackmore. She's professor of psychology down in Plymouth, and well, all sorts of interesting things that Sue's written on this very area as well, and we'll hear her own story. She believes, though, that ultimately there is no spiritual dimension to these things. Everything can be explained in a materialistic, naturalistic worldview. Hope you can stay with me right through to the end of the show today. So we'll welcome our guest in the studio now, Charles Foster. Charles, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be here, Justin. Thank you.
You're no stranger to this programme. You came in around Christmas time, I think, talking about another book, which was on the whole area of the Christmas stories, the narratives of Jesus' birth, etc., in the Gospels, which just shows how far and wide you throw your net as far as the subjects of interest that you take on board. You've also written on evolution and God. You've written on the resurrection of Jesus. But you're a barrister. You're not a sort of, you know, professional Christian writer in some sense. It's your hobby, is the impression I get. So what leads you to write all these diverse manner of subjects and books and things?
Lots of answers to that. I have a butterfly mind. I'm unable to keep a thought in my head for very long, so I need to put it down on a piece of paper or a computer before it vanishes away. But all my books are concerned with the question of what it means to be a human being and what on earth we're doing on this most extraordinary of all planets. I regard myself as a human being. I know quite a lot of other human beings, and I'm interested in what they are and what makes them what they are. So that's the common thread which runs through all these things. And obviously, Christianity has something to say about those questions.
Well, Wired for God is the latest book published by Hodder and Stoughton. And what led you specifically into this area, this whole area of spiritual experience and how it interacts with the brain, and when people claim to have had spiritual experiences, what are they actually experiencing? Fascinating stuff in the book, but where did it start off for you?
I've had spiritual experiences. Everybody I know has had spiritual experiences, even if they regard themselves as card-carrying atheists. It seems to me that everything that you can classify as a human being almost defines itself as a person who has that sort of experiences. And so, if I'm interested, as I am, in what makes a human being, it seemed to me to be crucial to go back and see if those experiences told us anything meaningful. Are they simply chemical reactions in our heads? Are we being misled into religion by these experiences? I wanted to know if the experiences that I've had that I arbitrarily label as spiritual were leading me down a blind alley, or whether I could conclude something useful from them.
I mean, inevitably, a spiritual experience is by its very nature a subjective experience, something that only the person who experiences it is privy to in some way, though the only way in which we can objectively look at it is through seeing, well, what's happening in the brain when that person experiences that thing. That's something we can all see, but it's still quite different, isn't it, seeing what's happening on a neurological level to what's happening to the person experiencing something.
Well, some people would say that all that a spiritual experience is the chemical reactions that happen, the electrical reactions that happen when that goes on. I think there's a little bit more to it than that. I think that, as I expect we will go on to explore, the fact that things happen observably in our brains when we have these experiences is not at all surprising and doesn't at all suggest that there's not something out there which is using those experiences in order to relate to us in some way.
Tell us then, and this is, I suppose, where we go from the academic to the personal, what were your spiritual experiences? What were the kinds of things that led you to conclude, well, hang on, this is something that's worth investigating? What did you experience?
Well, one very significant thing. I was wandering on an expedition through Sinai with a couple of Arab guides. It was for a very long time. It was an appallingly badly planned expedition by me, which meant that I had far too long to gaze at my own navel during it. I hadn't taken enough books. And I thought, oh, this will be fantastic. This will be fascinating. I can spend my time instead looking at that most fascinating of all creatures, Charles Foster. I will gaze into his multivariegated soul. But what a privilege. And so I looked. And it was like looking down into an empty, echoing well. I had a sense of actual vertigo because I couldn't see anything at all there. And the panic mounted as the expedition went on. And I assumed it was an artifact of loneliness. I assumed that when I got back to Alexandria and saw all the bustle there, it would go. It didn't. I assumed that when I got back to London and saw the bus going down the Strand, it would go. I got back to London, saw the bus, it didn't. And to cut a very long story short, I found myself at a church in London. Lots of your listeners will know about it, Holy Trinity Brompton. In Knightsbridge. And I found myself there. It was a very, very alien place for me to be. And I found myself standing in the balcony there, and suddenly I felt myself being physically filled from the soles of my feet to the top of my head. And as I was filled, the vertigo went away, and this emptiness was replaced by joy, love, lots of the sorts of things that are described by the great mystics in their spiritual experience. And tears came welling out. That's an extraordinary thing for somebody like me, highly English. I don't cry. I don't do that sort of stuff. But it was an experience which changed my life. I didn't have any theology to describe what was going on. All I knew was that I went in there empty, and I came away full of something which I regard as good, very, very good.
And were you later to come to label that with something like being filled with the Holy Spirit? Would that be a title you would give to it?
That is the label I now give, but it took a while to slap that label on. Yeah.
Mm. Interesting stuff. So obviously these are the kinds of religious experiences, spiritual experiences that people testify on a regular basis to. And we'll be looking at some of those sorts of things as well during the course of the programme. But they come in all sorts of shapes and forms, and indeed your book, Charles, sort of goes into all kinds of manner of different sorts of experiences around the world on in different ways that people claim to have had spiritual experiences. Well, our other guest on the programme today, as I mentioned, is Susan Blackmore. Sue, also not the first time she's appeared on this show in a way, because she very kindly came and contributed to a panel debate back in February that was part of a couple of live debates debates that we were holding on the whole area of intelligent design and evolution in response to the film, which had recently come to the UK, Expelled, the movie. So, Susan, thank you so much for agreeing to come back on the show.
I hope, pleasure.
Obviously, we didn't scare you away too much.
No, it's taken a little bit more than you lot. Maybe you should keep trying.
We'll see what we can do today, though. I have a feeling you and Charles will have a lot of shared areas of belief, but also probably a few distinctives.
Indeed.
Now, you're an atheist, Sue. Would you describe yourself, though, as a spiritual atheist? I don't know if that's a bit of an oxymoron.
Isn't that word difficult? Because you can talk about mystical experiences, but then that has all sorts of awful connotations. If you say spiritual, people think you mean that there is a spirit involved. So, you know, I feel that I have a spiritual path, if you like. I work hard at meditation and other aspects of my life, which I can't think of a better word for than spiritual work or something of that kind. But the word is bad because I don't believe there are such things as spirits.
I suppose this is the problem. We kind of mean something else, perhaps, by what other people take it to mean. But you do, I understand, sort of have certain, as you say, meditation techniques. I think a form of Buddhism is something that you're keen on. I mean, but you obviously take that away from any religious connotation. It's presumably purely a kind of internal exercise that is a mental exercise, ultimately.
Well, it kind of begins that way, but you do discover after a while that you can't hive off these things as being purely private because they affect everything you do. As far as Buddhism is concerned, Buddhism is atheist. There is no God in Buddhism, but it's become over the centuries a religion like many others with rituals and all of that kind of thing. So I do not call myself a Buddhist. I haven't taken the vows or signed up to any of the things that real Buddhists do, if you like. But I have been training in Zen methods for 30 years now, and that entails not only daily meditation, which I've done every day for about 20 years, and going on retreats and so on, but also paying attention in daily life, training yourself through mindfulness to be more aware in the moment, to be more here, to be aware. And that's what I consider to be Zen training, which I've been doing for a long time.
I mean, I was privileged. You sent me through some lyrics of you were recently married. So congratulations, firstly, for
to
your partner, Adam Hart Davis. And you sent me some lyrics of the some of the songs you used, and you'd taken some, you know, well-known Christian songs, Morning is Broken, for instance, and given taken God out of the equation, which was quite an interesting thing to look at. But
well, you see, one wants to... Well, there are several things. This is jolly tricky, this whole having a godless wedding, because on the basic down to earth side, people love to sing together. A wedding is a very special time, and you get together. We had loads of people here, and lots of family who don't get together very often, and you know it's a very special time. And singing together is wonderful. Well, how do you sing together? All of us, almost all of us, were brought up as Christians, and almost all of us have rejected that later on in life. But we still know the tunes. I mean, you know, when they come on the radio, Radio 4 on Sunday morning, you know, we sing along and sing Christmas carols and things. But obviously, it was a civil ceremony, and you're not allowed to have any mentions of God, and we wouldn't have wanted any anyway. But we want to have on a deeper level, on a special occasion like that, I want to be able to express awe at the amazingness of the universe and joy at being in love with somebody and wanting to spend your life with them. And you want those kind of sentiments. Morning Has Broken is a very simple example of that everybody knows, which it doesn't really depend on God. It's about, wow, there's a blackbird singing. It's so wonderful. And so we sung that, and then we had Bread of Devon, which is jolly naughty, I know, but we do live in Devon and we do love it. And Adam wrote some brilliantly funny words.
Well, anyway, it was really interesting to see that. And thank you for coming on the show. Now, we've asked Charles about his religious, spiritual experiences. Now, as an atheist, you know, people might think, oh, well, Susan's obviously never had anything like that. But that's not true. You, in a way, lots of your research came out of what for you was originally what you would have perhaps at the time labelled a spiritual experience. Would you mind recounting what happened and the kind of area of research it led you into?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think as a child I'd had certain kinds of experiences, which, you know, looking back, I feel, you know, that's how I am, like many, many children, seeing things in a different way and wondering what on earth it is. But the real turning point came when I was an undergraduate, when I first went to Oxford in my first term. And we were doing Ouija boards, which is a stupid thing to do. Whatever the mechanism behind it, it can be a silly thing to do, and I don't recommend it. But we did a lot of it, and we'd been doing this one night, and I was really tired. It was my first term. We'd been burning the candle at both ends. I was sitting around with some friends of mine late at night after this long Ouija board session, feeling really kind of bleary, listening to the music, and found myself going down a tunnel. It was a tunnel of leaves, and I can still remember it now. There's something extraordinary about these kind of experiences. People often say it was more real than ordinary life, and I can remember it as more real decades later, and that's true of this as well. So I was going down this dark tunnel of leaves, like a road with trees around, you know, and with a kind of roaring noise in my ears and in my head, and then a light came at the end of the tunnel, and I was going towards the light, and I rushed out into, you know, towards this light, and someone said to me, "Where are you, Sue?" And I, "Oh, no, what, you know, where am I?" And I tried to think of the room in college and where I was and everything, and everything sort of changed and shifted, and suddenly I was, it seemed, on the ceiling looking down, and I could see the three of us there. And I tried to talk and say, "I'm on the ceiling," and I actually could watch my own mouth trying to speak, which was extremely peculiar. The whole thing was extremely peculiar. Yeah. And I don't know really what to say, because it went on for over 2 hours, greatly encouraged by the fact that the guy sitting next to me, a good friend of mine, was very, very sympathetic and very much into occult stuff. And so he just kept on very calmly asking me questions. "Well, what can you see now?" You know, I think otherwise I would have sort of crashed back to normality, if you like, from fear, but I didn't, with his encouragement. And it went from an absolutely classic out-of-the-body experience into all kinds of other realms. At the time, you said at the time I thought of it as a mystical experience. I didn't. I thought of it as astral projection, because that's the only term that I knew that would cover it. The term out-of-the-body experience was not current then. The term near-death experience was not invented until 1985, 15 years later. It was only then that, looking back, I could see that I'd had almost all of the key components of a near-death experience. Looking down at my own body, traveling to other worlds, had the silver cord joining one to the other, then going to other realms, meeting a barrier where I had to decide whether I would go across this barrier, making the decision to return, meeting a being of light and other beings that seemed to be guiding me. I think really there were two things I would mention as being perhaps relevant to mystical or spiritual experiences particularly. One was that I became first very, very small and then very, very large. So large, in fact, that everything became me. I became one with the universe. And it was a very odd way of getting there, but I think the experience of oneness with the universe is common to people who have mystical experiences. And much described in religious literature, of course. So, you know, then the self has gone, not because it's been obliterated or disappeared, but because you realize that you actually are none other than the whole of the universe. And that was quite extraordinary. another thing I would say was, my friend asked me something like, "Well, what now?" Or, you know, I don't know. But I was, you know, looking. And it seemed to me that there couldn't be anything more, because if I was everything, then what more could there be? And something just sort of opened up somewhere in a way that I can't possibly make kind of in the three-dimensional or language sense of, but something opened up somewhere. And I was left with this feeling, wherever you go, there's always something further. And it was almost as though I'd glimpsed something looking at me, some kind of being, I don't know, right. Something like that. And then it was very, very hard to get back. It took me a couple of days to regain any kind of sense.
It's completely fascinating, and I hate to interrupt, because you've painted such a vivid picture there, and many people listening will be thinking, well, how on earth did you become an atheist? You know, surely all of this stuff is, you know...
Through a very, very, very long, complicated process. So, you know, my instant reaction was, wow, that proves that I've got a spirit and a soul, and that proves the possibility of life after death, and that proves, you know... I mean, I was just completely bowled over by, you know... This proves all kinds of stuff that I wasn't sure about before. And that was what led me to devote my life to becoming a parapsychologist, which is the only way I could see as a scientist fascinated by, you know, what is the mind and what is a human being? As Charles said, what is a human being? What are we? This seemed to challenge everything I was being taught in my degree on physiology and psychology. And I became absolutely determined to prove all these things and show that my close-minded lecturers and so on were wrong. And that it was many, many years of work from there before I began to have certain kinds of doubts and ultimately to change my mind completely.
So you ultimately did change your mind and came to believe that all of these experiences can be accounted for in a naturalistic, sort of materialistic way, that it is ultimately, well, to boil it down to it, the chemicals, the neurological processes and whatever, obviously operating in ways that are very unique and unusual, you know, but that there is an explanation.
Well, ultimately there'll be an explanation. We haven't got there, although we are making extraordinary progress. But I don't. You've worded that very carefully, and I appreciate that you've done that, because earlier on you said something like, "Oh, it's simply chemical. It's just chemical. It's nothing more than." And some people say that, and Charles said something about it. Simply, you know, and that sort of belittles what are extraordinary experiences that I think will really help us to understand the basic mysteries of. What is a human being? What is mind? How come we're conscious? What does it mean to be conscious? These are difficult things.
It's a great start to the show, we've hardly even got into the discussion yet, but some really interesting experiences being described there. Charles, you reference Susan quite a lot, actually, in your book, Wired for God, because obviously Susan has done so much research in these kinds of areas. But you do come to a different ultimate conclusion to Susan. Could you kind of elaborate a little bit of where probably the main differences are as far as your reading of the large swathe of religious and spiritual experiences that occur? Why you feel that we can't ultimately always assume there's a naturalistic or, if you like, explanation for these things?
Okay, there's a huge amount of evidence which both Sue and myself have surveyed. It seems to me that on balance, the evidence suggests that these experiences tell us something about something out there, which is trying to communicate with us. Sue, on balance, has concluded the opposite. I don't think we can say much more than that without going into the detail. Sue concludes very coherently, but I think wrongly, that there is no evidence for a soul, that the consistent use of personal pronouns that she had and what she said is really insignificant, that there's no Sue Blackmore that we can talk about who has any objective reality. When she sees green, there's nobody there who's really seeing it. I think that that is highly unlikely to be true. I think that the commonsensical explanation for our insistence that there is a Charles Foster or a Sue Blackmore to whom things happen is more likely to be true than the contrary.
And that religious experiences corroborate that, if you like, in some sense. They are consistent with that.
Religious experiences are the sort of things that you would expect something out there to use if it or he or she were trying to communicate with an I, a Charles Foster or a Sue Blackmore, who is real. Yes.
I mean, one of the most interesting areas I thought in the book was where you talk about scientific experiments that have been done, particularly by a guy called Andrew Newberg, who has actually scanned people's brains and what happens in the brain when, for instance, a nun is in a period of meditation or even someone is speaking in tongues and that sort of thing. Give us an idea of what he found and what your conclusions are from that data.
Right. Andrew Newberg got extremely experienced meditators, Buddhist monks and Christian nuns, to do what they're good at. Meditate. So the nuns meditated on the ancient centering prayer, repeating it over to themselves. The monks focused on a religious object. And when they got to their mountaintop experience, he asked them to indicate, and at that moment, some tracer would be injected into their brains. And then they were scanned, and it was possible to see which part of their brains was most active when they reached that mountaintop experience. And the results were very interesting. Some of them were very predictable, so the nuns were doing language things, and so the language bits lit up. The monks were doing visual things, and so the visual areas lit up. But two other areas were obviously affected, the parietal lobes and the thalamus. A bit of anatomy. The parietal lobes are what tell us where our body is in space. So if you have a tumour of your parietal lobe, you can end up trying to throw your leg out of bed because you don't realise that it's part of you. Mm. It tells you where you end and the rest of the world begins. In both the monks and the nuns, the activity of the parietal lobes was very much reduced.
So there was less sense of
their own body. They felt as if they were flowing into the universe, that they were continuous with the rest of the universe.
Perhaps not dissimilar to what Susan was describing earlier, this sense of becoming one.
Very much so, and consistent with all the language of particularly Eastern mysticism, becoming a drop of water in the great ocean, or whatever it is. So, very interesting. The other observation was that the activity of the thalamus was increased. Now, the thalamus acts as a sort of neurological gateway, a valve. It regulates the amount of information that flows into your brain. So if it's a Monday morning and your intray is stacked high, you're very, very, very awake, and the thalamus is very, very active.
It's wide open.
It's wide open, letting all that probably unwanted, resented information in. Normally, of course, on a Monday morning, your thalamus is active and also your parietal lobes are active because Monday morning at your intray is not a time when you have your mystical experiences. So normally the activity, the parietal lobes and the activity of the thalamus are related directly to one another. But in this study, while the parietal lobe activity was reduced, the activity of the thalamus was increased. So while you are having this experience of oneness with the universe, your thalamus was telling you, this is real. Mm. In fact, it's more real than your Monday morning life, which relates very well to what Sue was talking about. This, she said, felt like
more real,
more
than
real
the
than
normal life
than her normal activity. Yeah.
So I mean, we've given us a good overview of what he discovered when he looked at what was happening in the brain. I suppose the question we're going to come on to, and we will have to take a quick break here, and we'll allow Sue obviously to respond to this as well, is, well, what does that show us, that it is just the brain, as it were, causing these experiences, or is it the brain in some way conducting an experience that is from outside? I suppose this is one of the central areas which we need to tie down on and see why you take one view and Sue takes another. But you're listening to already a fascinating discussion here on Unbelievable. Not the kind of area we've tackled very often. We tend to go down a more words in a book kind of route on Unbelievable. We don't tend to look at subjective experiences all that often. But I think long overdue for looking at something along these lines. What does science tell us about these scientific experiences? Are we wired for God? That's the contention of my studio guest today, Charles Foster. He's a barrister and writer. He's a Christian. And atheist guest Susan Blackmore is on the phone. And she's a professor of psychology and has written widely in this area as well. So we're going to continue to talk about these spiritual experiences, whether we can come to naturalistic explanations of them, whether there's more to it than that. Also, something that Charles has already brought into the discussion, I think the whole area of consciousness. Is there a me inside my body, as it were? Or are we really just the results of a complicated physiology and biology, but nothing more. What's your conclusion then? Can we assume that then it is just brain activity, or is that a wrong sort of path to take, if you like?
I think it's the wrong path. If the Christians are right, then human beings are mind, body, spirit unities. And if there is anything in the notion of a spirit, then you'd expect things which happen in our spirit to have corollaries for the things which happen in our bodies. You'd expect things to happen on PET scans or whatever. So I think this work from Andrew Newberg flags up the danger of confusing correlation and causation, by which I mean this. ultra-reductionists would say, ah, Andy Newberg's scans show what they show. The spiritual experience is nothing but the lighting up of the thalamus, the lighting up of the parietal lobes. But correlation is something different from causation. Certainly the parietal lobe activity correlates with this feeling of oneness with the universe, but is it the same thing? There is a perfect correlation between being female and giving birth vaginally to a child. But being female doesn't cause it. And that confusion seems to me to be at the root of lots of modern materialistic objections to the legitimacy of spiritual experience.
Coming back to you, Susan, you're obviously fully aware of these kinds of studies and things. Do you think they give license to say, well, we can now say that there is a purely physical, if, as it were, causation for these kinds of experience?
No, no, and Charles is quite right to point out that the correlation caused confusion, because people make that all the time. It's very important in science to you find your correlations, which, you know, tend in any area to easier to find a correlation than then to work out what's causing it. So he's quite right to flag that up. Also, with the fairly sketchy results we have so far, we're way away from being able to say, yes, we've got it now, this is it, we understand it. We don't understand it completely, but we're getting all these clues, which are going in the direction that I think they're going in the direction that we will have these explanations. So let's take it a little bit further. If you just talk about certain areas lighting up, I mean, the parietal lobe is about a quarter of the entire cortex of the brain. It's a huge area. Loads and loads and loads of things go on there. So the fact that you've got more activity there, you know, could be telling you all kinds of things. But actually, there's been some really interesting research recently on out-of-the-body experiences. It actually started way back in the 1950s with Wilder Penfield, who was doing brain surgery with serious epileptics and happened to poke one little place. It's called the temporoparietal junction. It's where the temporal lobe and the parietal lobe meet. It's a little area there. And the woman said, oh, my God, I'm leaving my body. Well, this was just in the 1950s and nothing again until in the 2000s, in this millennium, when it was done much more carefully with modern techniques, again in an epileptic where they were trying to find the cause of this woman's problems, and were able to stimulate again and again and again tiny spots in the TPO junction and got induced out-of-the-body experiences. Subsequently, we found that if you interfere with that area of the brain, you can block certain experiences and you can induce them, and a lot of control has been gained. Now, this is really interesting. As Charles said, this part of the brain is a place where, that's why it's this junction, a critical junction part of the brain, where information is coming from different parts of the brain and being put together to make a body image. So it makes the image of where are my legs, where are my arms, without which you wouldn't be able to go around, not fall over your desk, pick up your cup of tea, drink it, whatever it is, because you need to, the whole brain needs to know which is my body, which is the outside world, which are the bits that these signals will control and which aren't, and that job is done in that part. And it's when you get activity there that you get strange bodily distortions and ultimately out-of-body experiences where you have a body image that is not coincident with the experiences going on at the time, and you separate out this sense of self from the body image. Now, the fact that we can do that and poke a bit of the brain and make it happen, interfere with it when it happens, that's getting closer towards a causal explanation rather than just a correlation. So we're getting there.
Yeah, well, your response, Charles, because in that sense I can see exactly what Sue means there. You know, you say, well, perhaps it is something outside us and that we just see a correlated activity in the brain. But Sue says, well, when you do stuff to the brain, stuff happens. So it looks like the brain is the thing that's causing it then.
Well, perhaps a better example, which makes the same point that Sue's making, is the example of prodding the brain with drugs. So you can reliably produce out-of-body experiences with the very common anesthetic ketamine. So common is it that when ketamine is used as an anesthetic, you give people amnesiac drugs so that they forget the
out-of-body experience,
the sometimes very disturbing out-of-body experience that they've had. So we can we can say that ketamine is somehow prompting or using the same biochemical pathways as the near-death experiences or the out-of-body experiences that Sue probably had in her room in Oxford.
Can I say something about ketamine, though? Because knowing this, you know, I thought, I must have ketamine and find out what it's like. And I was lucky enough to get in a situation where I was able to have a very high dose of ketamine injected with, you know, under good controls in a very pleasant situation. And it was kind of an out of, but it was more, I would say, a dissociative experience, which is normally what it's described in the literature. It wasn't that full-blown sense that I had had myself of being completely separated, of being wonderfully alive and alert. It was a kind of druggy,
Which is why it's used as an anesthetic, presumably, because you don't feel like it's happening to you when someone's operating on you.
Exactly.
Okay, but various drugs can produce those experiences. So can various types of activity. If you are a Kalahari shaman dancing until you're dehydrated and blood is spurting out of your nostrils around the campfire, you can, by dulling the usual war which there is between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, produce dissociative states like this. But what does that tell us? It seems to me that the romantic drug literature overstates the case for, first of all, the niceness of these drug experiences. Lots of the experiences that people have on these drugs, which use some of the pathways I say that genuine spiritual experience does, are really nasty. So, Sue, you will know the work that Rick Straussman at Harvard did on DMT, which is the active ingredient of ayahuasca. I mean, he had to stop the study because nearly half of his subjects had really unpleasant experiences.
A bad trip, to use the hippie terminology.
Had a bad trip. So they weren't all the time floating in a sea of bliss as described by the Eastern mystics. Some of them were being anally raped by dinosaurs or having really unpleasant experiences done to them. The second is that while drugs can produce this sense of oneness with the universe, genuine spiritual experience produces not a diminution in the self more often, but a sense of encounter, a sense of relationship. It's a much more intimately personal thing. So I suggest that the most coherent explanation of those observations from drugs, from other extreme physiological experience which induces out-of-body states, is that there are pathways there used by genuine spiritual experience which can be prompted by drugs, but that drugs are misusing them in some way. So
I'd kind of agree with the idea of misusing in the sense that people are endlessly misusing drugs. You can't say that any particular drug, DMT or LSD or cannabis or any of them, will reliably produce anything. All of these mind-altering drugs depend crucially on the set and setting, what you're expecting, where you are, what's around you, who's with you, what you know already, what kind of mind you have at the time, what kind of state you're in. They produce all sorts of different effects. They can produce what appear to be very, very similar to spontaneously occurring mystical experiences. So the question that's implicit in what you're saying there is, are these two things or one? Are there two sorts of things, the real mystical experience, a real spiritual experience, which actually is this whatever it is reaching out to the self in there and all the things you've described, or are they basically the same thing, which some drugs under the right circumstances can set off and people can have spontaneously and can happen under different circumstances? And here, of course, the most famous study trying to answer that question is the Good Friday study.
Yes.
In which 10 people were... This was done with trainee theology students who were going to be priests in the States. And 10 were randomly assigned to be given psilocybin, which is a hallucinogen, and 10 were given a control drug, which would have some similar physical effects so that they might genuinely think they had had the psilocybin. And they then spent Good Friday, as they would in their training, spending many, many hours contemplating the Passion of Christ. A deep, you know, a deep situation to be in, an appropriate situation. They were prepared properly. of the people who had the control drug, they had very few, rather shallow mystical experiences. Of the ones who had the psilocybin, I think 8 out of 10 described profound experiences, some very profound. Those experiences, they look indistinguishable from what similar theological students would call mystical and spiritual experiences. And they've been followed up a few years ago. This is many, many years after the original experiment. And they still remember those in the way that we've been talking about.
And find them to have been positive experiences that they would say contributed even to their faith.
Indeed, yes.
And I think you do mention those in the book, don't you?
I deal with them in detail, yes.
It's a fascinating thing, but I suppose the suggestion from you then, Susan, is that, well, look, drugs can have a good effect, they can have a bad effect, but the fact is they're having an effect, and when the effect is good, it's indistinguishable from the spiritual experience that Charles is trying to claim is a different thing.
Yes, although I don't like to classify it as good and bad necessarily. Yes, a lot of mystical experiences are wonderful. They can also be scary. I think good and bad isn't quite capturing it, but, you know, a spiritual or mystical experience. I mean, there can be experiences which I think are very important. Charles described this sense of looking into himself and finding nobody there. Now, is this good or bad? I'm not going to say. It's profoundly frightening. It really gives you a sort of sit up and look, what's going on here? Now, I didn't go on an expedition to Mount Sinai or whatever it was, but I've done a lot of meditation, and a lot of Zen meditation is deliberately pointing towards that search. So there are lots of these questions that get you to sit in meditation, calm your mind, sit quietly, be there with the singing of the birds or whatever it might be, and ask, okay, who's hearing that? And you discover, as Charles did, I haven't a clue. Ah! Help! Now, drugs can do that too. LSD is particularly prone, under the right circumstances, to inducing people into deep questioning about self. And this is because of its effect on the thalamus, which Charles has already described as the kind of gateway that allows in or doesn't allow in sensory experience. And it allows in a lot more, and you can become overwhelmed and everything becomes merged together. And can lead to this sense of, I don't seem any longer to be separate from the experiences that I'm having.
It's an interesting one, because obviously that links into what has been really your latest area of study, consciousness, Susan. I mean, coming back to you, Charles, this is something that you deal with. Many people might not think of this under the banner of religious spiritual experiences, but you felt strongly enough about it to include a large appendix in your book about the whole area of consciousness.
Yeah.
Because for you, this is actually quite fundamental to the whole point of spiritual experiences in some way.
Yes, and if I had thought that I could have made it accessible enough to have put it as a non-disconcerting first chapter of the book, I'd have put it there, because everything that I say in the book about spiritual experience presumes that there is an I to whom these spiritual experiences are happening. I am a great respecter of Sue's work on consciousness, and it's been a tremendous influence on me, but I think she's very, very wrong. Daniel Dennett mocks this idea of what he calls the Cartesian theatre. Cartesian because it refers to Descartes thinking, therefore I am. The idea that there is an I, a soul, call it what you like, who's sitting inside a theatre, looking out at the world through our own sense receptors. He says that is medieval and contrary to everything that modern science indicates. I think that it's far more consonant with what science suggests, and certainly far more consonant with our intuitions. Sue, as I understand her, will say simply that there's no Sue, there's no Charles Foster who exists. It's all an illusion. In that respect, she's a very conventional Buddhist.
I wouldn't say there's no Charles Foster, there's no Sue Blackmore. I'd say that Charles Foster is a story, an idea, a word, a feeling, whatever, that pops up for a bit and then disappears again. There isn't a continuous thing in there or spirit in there. Concrete thing, but there is nothing there that's continuous, that lives through your life, that is the experiencer who has all those experiences, is the one who has the free will and controls the body. And all of that is untrue. There is this fleeting, ever reappearing thing that we give the name.
Yeah, so as I understand it, we have events that happen to us, we have experiences, and we have some sort of software which links them together. And the tale that we arbitrarily create, which gives some sort of continuity to those experiences, because we hate uncertainty, we hate things being unlinked, is what we wrongly label the self.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But I'd like to describe it slightly differently. I mean, first of all, there are bodies, you know. There's the Charles Foster body, and there's the Sue Blackmore body sitting here at its desk with its computer, and I can say, you know, here I am, here's the desk, this is my computer, this is my head, you know. So these things are here. There's also the whole kind of personality thing, you know, there's my website out there, people can look up what I've done and so on. So that in that sense, there is a person. But if I also think that all these are because in here there is the me, the one who is now seeing the green tree out of the window, the one who is now curiously making hand signals as though I were, you know, as though that you were looking at me. That's the mistake. That's the illusion. And it's so easy to fall into the illusion that we explain our human circumstances and what we are by adding in this extra thing which we call the real me. Mm. Or if we're religious, we might call the spirit or the soul or something like that. It's so tempting because it seems to make sense of all these mysteries about human consciousness and the world, but actually all it does is lead us straight into a dead end because it has no explanatory power at all.
Well, it does explain, for example, your love for your husband. It explains your constant use of personal pronouns in our conversation. It explains the very vibrant personality which oozes out of everything that you write.
I mean, these are not though scientific.
I don't mind if they're not scientific. I mean, science is fabulous, but it's not everything in the world. But the point is, yes, it may explain the use of the pronoun in the sense that it's such an easy, tempting theory to fall into that I am body and me, body and spirit or whatever, and then it's easy to think that's what I'm using the pronoun to describe. I think what's really happening is, as a child, when we first learn to say I, you, him, her, we're talking about bodies, but then in our complex language and our complex world, we start to talk about I like this and I don't like that and I want this and I don't want that and I hate him and I want to, you know, whatever it might be. And these all imply a kind of self who's in there that has opinions and has experiences. And we build up this illusion through the complexities of human language and culture. But you talked about love. I mean, here's a really important one. I love my husband. I love the world. I love my cat who's sitting on the chair over there. And I love my children. Why has this got to do with this illusion of an inner self? The reason human beings are capable of love, I would say, is because of the way we're built. We're animals built to have families and children. Love works in keeping us together and making our life better. And we have an amazingly clever brain that can ask questions like, well, why am I in this world and what is this world? And then we become struck by the extraordinariness of it all and we can love the beautiful things in the world. I don't see that in any way is explained by inventing a spirit or a soul that's doing the loving.
So you know better than almost anyone how pitifully inadequate the conventional Darwinist explanations for consciousness are. Yes. And I don't think that you would seek to suggest that there is any explanation that we can even imagine the vague shape of at the moment for consciousness.
No, but the Darwinian explanations of things like love and affection and nurturing and all sorts of things are pretty good because we can see in the way we've evolved and in our closest relatives with these behaviours and we can look genetically. So in terms of those, and also in terms of things like sharing things and kindness and altruism, Darwinian explanations are doing very well indeed, and with lots of, you know, hiccups along the way, as always in science, but they are. But you're absolutely right when it comes to consciousness. I really enjoy working in this field because it's one of those fields that's deeply mysterious.
I mean, Charles is smiling away broadly here, but Charles, I wonder, sort of, is your problem with the way that Susan approaches this whole area that it is by its nature reductionist? It does it Do you feel that there's a presupposition at work here?
Not really. I don't have any problem with reductionism when it does a good job, but I just don't think it does here. And
it's, consciousness, I agree. We haven't found a way of doing it that way.
Yeah. So why not go with what intuition screams out is correct? Daniel Dennett famously says that anything which is which intuitively appears to be the case must be wrong. And it seems to me that in the realm of consciousness studies, that there's a bit of that sort of perversity which is dictating the agenda.
Well, Dennett is very famous, but not much liked. I mean, people find it terribly hard to throw off their intuitions, as he suggests they should. And one shouldn't take that statement of his to mean, you know, in all areas of life or all areas of science, intuitions are wrong, but specifically with respect to the nature of self and consciousness. I think he's right, but then, you know, I spend a lot of my time staring into my own mind, and not implying that there is someone there who's doing the staring, sitting down staring, seeing this stuff, feeling the intuitions come up, having a look at them, and seriously, so that's in the experience, and then in the science saying, right, do these intuitions work? Do they help explain? Now, if you take the simple intuition that there is a spirit or a soul or something conducting the affairs of this brain, there are so many scientific and philosophical reasons for thinking that there can't be. I mean, to take just some very simple ones, we know, for example, if you ask people to do spontaneous actions of their own free will, you can measure in the brain the activity in the relevant motor areas of the brain.
Libet's delay.
Yes, starting up before the time at which the person feels, now I'm going to do it. You can look at all kinds of actions that we do. For example, often in classes, when I teach consciousness classes, I just scrumple up a bit of paper and hurl it into the room, and somebody will just put their hand up and catch it. Now, we know from the timings in the brain and the timings of people's experiences and so on that people will catch that before they are conscious that anything is coming towards them, or certainly before they're conscious of what it is. That comes later. We can piece those things together. Now, it seems to me, if you know, even while I'm sitting here, but certainly if I was walking out in the garden, I don't fall over things. There's a part of my brain that is looking for objects, making sure the legs go this way. There's another bit that's listening out for things. There are movement detectors that will shift my eyes this way and that to see interesting things happening. And then the actual perceptions of that's a blackbird, that's a fish, in the, you know, come much more slowly because they take much more brain power. When we look into what's going on in the brain, we don't see a sort of central point which all the information comes into, where this spirit or soul or whatever could be kind of looking at it and experiencing. It isn't like that. It's a massively parallel system with all kinds of behaviors, even the words I speak, being controlled by different parts of the brain according to what's flowing through different pathways. So given that understanding of the brain, what would this spirit be doing? It's not needed, and there's nowhere for it to interact if it works.
It's a kind of unnecessary embellishment in some ways. But, Charles, just a quick response, and then we must move on to the next part of it.
Two comments on the fascinating and mysterious experiment that Sue's described, which is referred to as Libet's delay. Some people might say that work is more consistent with there being some great theistic puppet master outside pulling the strings than it is with your model of the universe. But secondly, you've said, Sue, that if Libet's delay indicates that we don't have free will, you can see that we still have a free won't, as you put it, because we still have the ability to override.
You said that in your book. No, I totally disagree with that. It was Richard Gregory, who has died about 3 weeks ago. It was he who said, oh, ho, ho, because he loves puns. So Libet says we don't have free will, we've only got free won't, ha. It was actually because Libet did these experiments on vetoing, in which he claimed that although the brain reactions for doing something, deciding to do it, came too late to be the cause of that, people could consciously veto things. Now, I think he was wrong. There are very complex arguments about the precise way the experiments were done. But it wasn't me who said that. I don't think we have either free will or free won't.
Well, you're in a minority there, aren't you?
I am indeed. But it's a very, very interesting and important question whether we
have free will. We're going to have to go to a quick break, and I hate to break up the flow of conversation.
We think about whether we've got free will.
Yes, indeed, during this quick break. So you're listening to an edition of Unbelievable with two very brainy guests joining me on the programme today. Charles Foster is the author of Wired for God? Published by Hodder and Stoughton, and asks, what about the biology of spiritual experience? And as I say, a cornucopia of different types of spiritual experiences are examined by Charles in the book, as he asks, what happens in the brain? And could it be there is an outside influence, or is it all just in the brain in that sense? Our atheist guest is Susan Blackmore, Professor of Psychology, and she's been explaining how her research has led her to the belief that actually we are, well, I don't like to use the word simply, it's more than simply, but her point would be that we are, in the end, a very complex set of circumstances and physiology, but there's nothing beyond there, out there, as it were, that's doing things to us. Charles, you are a Christian. In the course of researching this book, did it throw up questions about, well, obviously there are people having all kinds of spiritual experiences around the world, be they Hindu, Muslim, Christian, or even atheist like Susan, having experiences of one kind or another. What did this ultimately lead you to in terms of how you, as it were, integrate that in your Christian faith? Did it give you answers to the questions that had emerged from your own spiritual experience? Are there ultimately, is this all quite nebulous and we can't tie down exactly how this all fits into the grand scheme of Christian faith in particular?
I did get tentative answers, and I found those tentative answers more reassuring than they were frightening. I surveyed religious experience, and I saw that there's a great deal of agreement amongst all human beings about the sorts of experiences which they label as spiritual. I also observed that lots of these spiritual experiences can be approximately mimicked by ecstatic dancing, tantric sex, magic mushrooms, whatever. And to begin with, that mimicry puzzled me. And then I noticed that the mimicry wasn't really very good. There are obviously some pathways in our heads which are used by those other techniques, but those other techniques don't use it properly. The mimicry isn't complete. I think that begs the question, what are those pathways for? There are no obvious other reasons for them to be there. And it seems to me that the simplest explanation is that they're there because something out there wants to flow through those pathways into us. And it seems to me that's likely to be God.
I mean, inevitably, the vast majority of people's experiences are anecdotal. They're not done under laboratory conditions. We can't all be having a scan of our brain going on at the moment. We wander into those situations, you know. But I mean, is there something in this, to, you know, where we'd say, you would say, look at the vast swathe of things that are happening out there, and that it's somehow, to boil it all down to just a reductionist, materialistic thing for you is too big a leap in some sense?
I think we should employ in this, as in all other areas, the basic principle that you should adopt the simplest explanation for things. And it seems to me to be that the simplest explanation for the massive evidence about religious experience is that they tell us something about a God who's objectively there.
You do spend a little time talking about the person of Jesus in the book, and many who have experienced spiritual experiences, particularly in the Eastern sort of traditions, would say, well, he was a great shaman. He was, you know, someone who was able to channel these kinds of things in a rather unique way. What's your sort of response to that sort of a claim?
C.S. Lewis talked about Jesus as the person to whom all the dying and rising God myths of the Mediterranean was pointing, as the fulfilment of all those prophecies. And it seems to me that something rather like that is going on here. Is Jesus the great shaman? Yeah. He's a person who actually took, if the Christians are right, the trip to the other world and came back to tell us about it. Other lesser shamans take metaphorical trips, sometimes through the medium of out-of-body experiences. But he took a real one.
Well, interesting thought to end on the programme there from Charles Foster. Sue, you obviously, you're quoted on the book cover for Charles's book, quoting this as serious and entertaining, but in the more expanded version of that inside, you say, but with some serious, you know, differences of opinion, ultimately, conclusion.
I really struggled to find people who would endorse the book who would actually say that they agreed with the thesis.
but see,
well, I think it's a good book, and I enjoyed reading it. But in the end, it comes to this. Charles says, the simplest explanation. It's a vacuous and pointless explanation. Well, not pointless, because people feel reassured and somehow they feel happier. Some people feel happier with the thought that God's doing it. But it certainly isn't an explanation, because we have no theory about what God is, what he's capable of or not capable of. He's supposed to be capable of anything. So that means it's not an explanation at all. I mean, I'm looking out of my window now at a bridge over a little river, and I could ask, why does the bridge stay up the way it does? Oh, God holds it up. It's a very simple explanation, but it's a useless one. We need to understand basic physics and Newtonian principles and all sorts of other things, and we can understand why you need a certain shape to hold the bridge up. Why is the water flowing down to the sea? You know, the history of ideas shows people, you know, started off with, well, you know, it wants to get down and so on, and then came to ideas about gravity and fluid mechanics and all these kinds of theories. Now science has moved on so far, we're tackling really difficult things, the nature of the brain and what it means to be human. They're really difficult questions we're asking. It's no better in these situations to say God did it. It's not an explanation at all. It's so simple as to be completely vacuous. That isn't to say it isn't true. I can't prove it isn't true. It doesn't get us anywhere. When we want to ask, what is human consciousness? Why is it like this? What happens to people when they have these amazing experiences? What is a self? You know, I want to say, A, let's do the science and look at the brain, and B, thinking about the self. When people have these extraordinary experiences of oneness with the universe, my intuition is something like this. Well, we are one with the universe, because actually all the science is telling us, all the molecules in my body are just molecules like the molecules in that bridge and the molecules in that tree and those cows over there. We are actually just the stuff of the universe. It's our arrogance and stupidity that leads us to think we're somehow separate and special and looking at it from in here, you know, being there's me and then there's the world. No, there's just the universe and I'm part of it. That, to me, is the profundity of the mystical experiences, that you see that truly how it is. And then you come back to the ordinary world in which it's I, me, and we're trapped in it.
Is for you that the kind of the ultimate zenith, this sense of being one with a grand scheme of things, the universe, etc., Charles, or is it important that we recognise our individuality and that we are? Well, I suppose the Christian would say, you know, we are made in the image of God, but that suggests we're different, part of, different to the creation is different to the creator.
Yeah, I have had in my life, and they've been some of the most profoundly moving and salutary experiences of my life, experiences of oneness with the universe, such as Zen talks about, such as Sue's talked about. Do I think those are illegitimate from a Christian point of view? Absolutely not. But the Christian contribution to this is that that experience of oneness with the universe is filtered through a personality which I have, which is said to be real, which is said to be precious, which is said to be unique, which is said to be eternal. So I don't see that this dichotomy that Sue is trying to assert is a real one. I think it's an unreal one, and I think it's a corrosive one.
We are going to have to draw things to a close there, but it's been a really, really great to have you both. You know, I'm sure we'll get all kinds of different responses in regard to this. But
sure you will.
Thank you very much, Sue, for taking the time out to talk to us on the phone. And if people want to go to your website, that's susanblackmore.co.uk. Links to all your books, especially your latest works on consciousness, which obviously we spent some time talking about here. So thank you very much for being with me on the programme today.
You're welcome.
All the very best to you. Thanks also to you, Charles. I hope you'll come back again when you decide to strike out on another subject, perhaps. Anything in the pipeline? Anything that's been there?
I'm writing an academic book at the moment on human dignity and whether it's a useful concept in medical ethics.
Oh, right. Well, we'll get you back for that when it's when it's been published. Okay. In the meantime, would you like to remind people of the name of your website if people want to go?
It's www.charlesfoster.co.uk.
There you go. So almost exactly the same, just a different name. SusanBlackmore.co.uk for Susan, CharlesFoster.co.uk.
You've been listening to a classic replay edition of Unbelievable. You can get in touch with your thoughts at our show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and you'll find further resources, the back catalogue of shows, and ways to support the show too. Thanks for being with us, and see you next time.